I'm Jim Hanley from the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics and Occupational Health at McGill. Welcome, Barry Pless, to this interview on behalf of the department. You know that we're coming up on 50 years of our academic program in the department. It was called Epidemiology and Health, I think, when you joined. So let me explain what we're up to. We're several reasons to interview. One's get an account of how you came to our department and the role you've played in it, and you know, how it's evolved over time, a little bit of department interest. But more generally as well, I want you to expand on issues that maybe haven't been covered as much as you'd like to in your writing and in your addresses at conferences and so on. Or I want to hear of issues that should be on the radar but aren't and have been forgotten. And then, of course, a little bit of looking ahead and what's in store for epidemiology and for our profession, and interested to hear what advice you have for the next generation. So if that's okay, then I like to start, though, right at not your entry into epidemiology, but your entry into the world itself. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about that. You were born in 1932 in Toronto.
That's correct.
That's right, yeah. Yes. And I'm always interested in what kind of parents people had. Did yours have a lot of education?
No, not at all.
No?
No. My father was an immigrant from Russia and came when he was probably in his early teens and moved to Brantford and finished high school, and that was it. The only important high school story I remember about from him was being thrown over the goalpost because he was quite small. I don't know whether it's true or not, but that was his recollection of high school.
Yeah, and your mother?
My mother, I honestly don't know whether she completed high school or not. I suspect she didn't. She was the daughter of immigrants from Poland.
I see.
And she died when I was 14 or 15. She had leukemia.
Oh.
So that's it.
And how many siblings are there?
I have a sister who was chair of occupational therapy at the University of Toronto.
Wow.
So, like my wife, she's an OT. My wife is a
PhD. That explains that connection. And do you think place in the family matters? Birth order, you were the older or the younger?
I was the oldest. Older.
Yeah. And so, family circumstances then wouldn't have been that
not at all. No,
yeah.
My father was a traveling salesman in the clothing business, and he was gone 5 days a week.
I see.
For all of my childhood, and as long as
but
I can remember.
We had one other guest that I interviewed who was very loath to talk about his childhood being deprived. You didn't consider yours deprived.
Well, not deprived. I think it was.
Did you have to have outside jobs or any of that sort of thing, or work your way through? Or
well, when I got to university,
yeah.
I had some scholarships,
yeah.
And then I had summer jobs, of course. But we lived with my grandparents until I was 7 or 8 years of age, and that was a sort of a big small house in Toronto.
I see.
Now Chinatown.
Yeah, and I think of from the scholarship point of view, I mean, what were the favorite schools? Were you a serious scholar early on, or were you one who would like to duck out of school?
I didn't think I was a serious scholar, but looking back on it, certainly looking back on my high school years.
Yeah.
Are we taking a break?
Yeah, we should, until they find out.
It's what, clearing snow, are they?
Is it outside?
Yeah, he's shoveling the snow.
Okay. Okay, so keep going, yeah.
I didn't think I was a serious scholar, although I do remember my first library book when I was 5 or 6 years of age, going over to the Settlement House in Grange Park, and with great excitement, bringing back 3 library books. So that was
that's interesting.
Probably
yeah.
The beginning.
Yeah. And then what about sports and other outside activities?
No great sports, although both my father and I were keen swimmers. But in high school, I got involved in Gilbert and Sullivan performances, and I was always the comic lead for, I think, 4 years in a row.
Yeah, and well, that's interesting you mentioned the library and getting books early from the library. So, you know, you're going to the library at an early age, and you're keen that your grandchildren read and be read to.
Well, starting with our children, of course, we both, my wife and I, but particularly my wife, read an enormous amount. And one interesting thing that we recalled was that we always read a little bit above what we thought their normal age level would be.
I see.
And we chose books that we thought we would enjoy, and usually they rose to the level of our interests.
Do you think children today are being read to as much? I don't get
I'm afraid not.
I'm afraid we're losing.
Yeah, I think
something
so.
There. Yeah.
But I go into the children's library and I'm just astonished that I'm trying to write a children's book and the competition is pretty ferocious.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Now, so you ended high school after that little interlude and having to redo some of the language stuff, is that right? That's why you were a little late in that.
Well, I managed to fail Latin, or to drop Latin, because I didn't enjoy it.
Uh-huh.
Didn't think I would ever have any use for it. And then I failed French, and without a language, you couldn't go to university.
Well, they didn't insist on Latin or Greek in medical
school
at that point.
No, Greek was never an issue.
No,
Greek was not an option.
It was
Latin and French, and most people would. Heading for university would do both.
I see.
And I ended up with neither, and so I had to do an extra year.
Yeah, but were you heading for medicine early on?
No, not at all. I was actually I wanted to write, and my plan was to do sociology and philosophy at U of T.
I see.
And I was persuaded at the very last moment by my father. Who argued that there were other great writers who were physicians and why should be medicine.
I see. So you did 2 years of pre-med and 4 years of medical school at Western in London, Ontario. But interestingly, I noticed you also got a BA with honors over the same period or a little later. You got the MD in 58, I think, and the BA in 60. Something like that. It was by extension course.
Yeah, it was probably closer to about 62.
Yeah, it was by extension course.
Well, it was both extension and night school in London. I did actually a wonderful course in modern English poetry at City Lit, which was sort of an open university.
I see.
And the reason behind that was that if you did pre-meds and did well, you went straight on into medicine, so you had equivalents of 2 years towards your bachelor's, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of felt that my education was incomplete, so I ended up doing economics by correspondence while I was an intern.
What was correspondence like in those days? They would send you books, you'd send it back, it'd be corrected?
I don't know whether they sent us the books, but...
But the correction, the work, and
absolutely,
so on,
the assignments.
Back and forth by mail.
I have copies.
Do you think today that there's a place for distance education?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
I mean, certainly the Open University model in the UK, which has been going on for, 40 years, 50 years, is bound to happen. Whether it's through television, as it is there, or... whether it's through the internet, but it's begun, of course.
Yeah. Now, in medical school, I'm trying to find out when you started heading towards epidemiology and public health and so on. In medical school, did you want to be a medical researcher or a clinician?
I hadn't really thought a lot about it, but there were two events, I suppose, that tore me in both directions. I did very well in pediatrics and won a prize, which was a pediatric textbook, and I thought, I was one step ahead of the game, I might as well carry on in that direction. But I also had an incredibly good biochemistry teacher, Roger Rossiter. And I mean, the influence of great teachers on people's career should never be underestimated. Mm-hmm. And I got a 97 or 98 on a biochemistry exam, and I thought, well, that's really interesting. He taught so well that my interest in the subject was aroused. And I thought I was going to do pediatrics. I went and did a rotating internship at the Montreal General, which allowed you still to make a decision. And then I applied for a British Council scholarship and wanted to do biochemistry at the Hammersmith.
And I see you did chemical pathology, I think.
Well, it was just another name for the same thing.
Yeah.
I actually worked with a Canadian who had been there for 20 or 30 years, whose name was E.J. King. Old-timers will remember the measure of prostate, something or other. Prostate enzyme, King Armstrong units was the term, how it was measured, and he was the king of that.
I see.
And I worked on the dialysis of the artificial kidney, and I discovered that I couldn't pipette without ingesting some urine, so I thought that was not my career, and abandoned research, laboratory research.
Right. So now, as I'm sort of tracking you in towards epidemiology, first I want to ask you, is epidemiology the right name for what you've done over the years? It's as good as any, or do you see a different name for
When I first went to the UK as a fellow, I thought I was doing what I called social pediatrics, which I thought of as more broadly than epidemiology. I thought of epidemiology as being the research tool that social pediatric people would use. But there were lots of social pediatricians who were not researchers, and relatively few pediatric epidemiologists at the time.
I always like to operationalize it by asking, when the guy at the border says to you, "Oh, I see you're a doctor," and he wants to find out about his mother-in-law and her ailments, and he says to you, "What do you do?" What do you tell him?
I usually identify myself as a pediatrician, which is friendlier for people at the border than epidemiologists who are likely to be skin doctors.
Yeah. So you had a year at the rotating intern, then Hammersmith for a year. 2 years residency in pediatrics at the Montreal Children's, 2 years as a research and clinical fellow at Harvard Medical School, and then a short fellowship in statistics and epi at the London School of Hygiene. And so I'm curious, who were the influential people there along the way? Were you on your own path already?
No, I had gone to Boston on the advice of Charles Scriver, who was my mentor and chief resident here, to work with Bob Haggerty, who was the only person in the States at the time who was doing anything that roughly fell into the rubric of social pediatrics. And unfortunately, he was on a mini sabbatical he had a Markle scholarship, and he was in Britain that year. I ended up at the Mass General with a team of researchers, Jack Connolly and Dick Kearsley, and that was my first introduction to social pediatric research. And it focused on children with chronic disease. When Bob Haggerty came back, we kept in touch, and over a period of 7 years later, I ended up working for him as my chief in Rochester.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I see. So that's the American connection, I was wondering about that. Now, just out of curiosity, do you remember any of the standard epidemiology and statistics textbooks at the time? Or?
Yes, I certainly remember Bradford Hill. I think the book was called Medical Statistics.
Yes, that's right.
And to this day, I still think of it as being one of the better medical stats books.
Yeah.
It was understandable, and it was well written.
Yeah.
The epidemiology
book.
There
was epidemiology in it, too, a good bit of epidemiology.
Well, I've never made the distinction as sharply
exactly,
as some other
exactly,
people do.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
The epi book that we use in England in the London School of Hygiene course, I'm having trouble remembering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you ever meet Hill or Dahl or any of them?
I met Dahl, not Hill.
Yeah.
It was Donald Reed was the head of the epidemiology.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the Dahl most like? Influential people in during that period, I ended up moving on after I did that course to have an appointment at St. Mary's Hospital and did some work there with a man named Tom Oppie. But he introduced me to a team that was doing a very important study of the relationships between education, health, and behavior, which was a total population survey of 10 to 12-year-olds on the Isle of Wight. And so we went and lived on the Isle of Wight. This took place in November, December, which was not the time to travel in unheated cars.
Somebody who lived in an island myself, in the Atlantic, I can understand.
But
heating would not have been up to Canadian standards, that's for sure.
And the people who ran that study were Jack Tizard, who died a few years later, a psychologist, a wonderful man from New Zealand, and Michael Rutter, a psychiatrist, and it was an extraordinary experience, and I was the only pediatrician in the group, so it was I did lots of household interviews and got involved in an analysis of the data. And then when I came back to London, went to the London School of Economics and got involved in the 1946 British Birth Cohort Survey, the National Survey of Health and Development, I think it was called. And that was under the aegis of James Douglas.
That was the one with the 1 week of birth?
That's correct. Yeah. That's right. It was all the children born in the UK between March 6th and 13th. Mm-hmm. 1946, mm-hmm. who were followed.
They're still following?
They're following the grandchildren now.
Wow. Yeah.
So they have three generations of data.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for practical reasons, they had to reduce the sample, so they took one in three sample to pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing experience.
So, that was sort of your first job, I think, wasn't it?
I wasn't paid at either of these places.
Oh, no.
I was still on fellowships
from
the Milbank Foundation.
Interesting, yeah. Now, somewhere along the way, you got married, you met your wife, got married, had children. When did they come along?
That partly explains why I went to Britain in the first place in the Hammersmith year. I had met my wife when I was a medical student, and I was working in a veterans hospital for room and board, along with three of my classmates. And we were housed in the nurse's residence, and my wife was spending a year from the UK, and she was a physio, so we met in the swimming pool at that hospital.
I see.
Fell in love, and I then spent 7 years trying to persuade her to marry me, and she finally agreed. Yes.
I see. And the kids came along at what stage in your career?
Kids came along, we were married in 62, and the first child was born in 64, and the second one first child was born in Boston, the second child was born in London, England, and the third child was born in Rochester, New York.
Very good. And have they followed you into any of these professions, or have you scared them off? Like, I've scared most of mine off from my profession.
No, our eldest daughter is a national sales manager for Pepsi-Cola.
Uh-huh.
Our oldest son...
Do you have any trouble with her on arguments about children's drinks?
No, you leave
her to it?
No, she's as revolutionary as I am. Which doesn't make Pepsi very happy, but that's their problem.
Yeah.
Our oldest son did history and philosophy and then decided to go into medicine, and he's a family doctor. And our youngest also did history and philosophy and went into law, and he works for the Justice Department.
Interesting. So you've explained now your first job in the United States because of Haggerty in Boston,
right,
coming back to work with him. That first job, I noticed you were both a researcher in a community child health study,
mm-hmm,
and director of children's rehab.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
Was that part of your work?
No, actually the research was the more important part. I wanted to do clinical work, and there was a need for somebody to work with particularly with children with rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
And so I co-ran that clinic.
Yeah. And the arthritis side, was there a research component to that?
There was actually. We did a couple of studies that involved those children,
yeah,
but there were many other studies going on under the aegis of the broad National Center grant support. This was the beginning. It's important to have this fixed in time. This was the period between 1967 and 1975 when
that's
I
was right,
back
there
to
were
Canada.
7 years, yeah.
And those were the Camelot years for research of the kind that we were doing in Rochester. And Rochester was, because of Haggerty, the focal point for that. So most of the people who became the big names in social pediatrics or pediatric epidemiology, community child health, whatever you want to call it, had come through that department at the time. And so there was a lot of money, a lot of excitement, a lot of hope and expectation.
Yeah,
that
the late 60s were a golden time for a lot, a lot of areas.
Neighborhood health centers were being born. Things were tilting to the left. It was a good time.
It's interesting. I mean, your first job, you were 30. You were. What did I see? 36 or so before you had your first paid job. And then
it was $14,000. $14,000.
Yeah, and it's a huge investment to spend what some people would consider half their life at that time to before one started working.
Yeah, well, when you're a slow learner, you know, you have 4 years of fellowship.
Well, no, but now you put it out of, 100 years people are looking at it as a horizon nowadays instead of 70 or 60.
No, I mean, I think the two fellowships back-to-back were a lot.
And then you came to McGill at around age 43, and you've been at McGill for 35 years.
That's correct.
Who recruited you here, or how did that come about?
Good question. We had decided we wanted to leave Rochester because the children were getting to high school age, and we were faced with some difficult choices, and we were never prepared to send our children to private schools. So we were living in the inner city at the time, and the high school was pretty rough. So it was time for a move. We knew that eventually we wanted to come back to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking at, I was looking at jobs in Hamilton and Ottawa and Montreal, more or less at the same time.
Yeah, and of course you'd had the experience here before as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I was on the verge of taking the job at McMaster, and things fell apart. The dean got a bit pushy, and
Was it O'Season or Corbett?
It was O'Season who was involved, but I think the recruitment came more through pediatrics. They had some money in a fund that had been left as a legacy for somebody to do research involving handicapped children at the Alex, which was in the Point. Point St. Charles,
mm-hmm,
and so that was what they were using to recruit
you.
And I'm trying to remember who the chair was at the time.
In pediatrics.
In pediatrics. We'll stop, shall we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, any wire will do it, I think, yeah. I get it sometimes on the iPod.
Are you satisfied?
Yeah.
Are they too long-winded?
No. No, I don't mind as long as we last. I don't mind how long we go.
Hey, pardon?
I don't mind how long we go. As long as
no,
we
no,
get
I
to
mean,
the main.
But are the answers
no, no, no,
too
that's fine, that's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
No, no, that's fine. You know, it's interesting trying to guess through stuff when you read a CV how
yeah,
things happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't get it.
Yeah,
you, no, no, no. Yeah, it's interesting also, you know, at that time, you know, 77, I was in Boston at the time. I'd been in Buffalo, and I actually used to go back and forth to Rochester to a guy in radiation therapy, that Phil Ruin. He was in charge of radiation therapy. And
Ooh.
We were involved with the
yeah,
radiation
I remember.
Therapy
yes,
oncology
yes.
group, so
yeah.
I often went by car from Buffalo to Boston from 73 to 77,
sure,
the Strong Memorial,
yeah,
and then moved down to Boston. But then
we went
had
from Buffalo to Boston?
Buffalo, we
Buffalo
were 4 years in Buffalo and then
yeah.
3 years in Boston.
Okay.
And but the Buffalo, Rochester, I used
yeah.
to go by car to see
yeah,
him
sure,
when we were dealing
sure.
with stuff.
Yeah.
And flying from Rochester to and Buffalo to Philadelphia was where the data center was,
yeah,
and
yeah.
they were horrible flights,
yeah,
I remember,
I
the Allegheny.
That's right.
But we had the same questions about getting back to Canada as well.
Yeah.
Because we didn't.
But how old were you when you left Ireland?
22, and then I was 26 when we took my first job in Buffalo, and 33 by when I came to McGill. Yeah.
Sure.
But again, I had no idea that I didn't know anything about McGill actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. My wife is from here, so that was one of the things
that
brought us back.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, so we were talking about who recruited you to the department, and of course you had two. You had a home department of pediatrics,
mm-hmm.
but also our department of epidemiology and health, I think it was called at the time. And you said it was Bob O'Season who
absolutely
yeah enticed you in there.
He invited me for lunch, and it turned out to be a bowl of soup, and that was as far as we got, but that was enough to encourage me to join.
Yeah, and he, at that time, the department was moving, I think, from being focused on occupational health, asbestos, and so on under Corbett, and then O'Season, my impression, made it a very clinical, much more clinical focus. No, was that deliberate, or just... what was your...
I don't know that it was... I think it was the fact that there were about the same time I came, Walter Spitzer came, and
yeah.
Walter went to the general
yeah.
and set up the clinical epi unit there with Kellogg's support.
Yeah.
And so whether that was as a result of O'Season's initiative or Walter's initiative, it's hard to tell.
See. But then we, you know, I saw then Mike Kramer came soon after that, in a few years, and a number of clinical people.
Yeah, I recruited Mike.
Yeah.
I had a call on New Year's Day from Mike's mentor,
mm-hmm.
and said, you have to bring this guy to Montreal.
That's right, and then Tom Hutchinson came more clinical.
So
and I still remember the ones who recruit you, you'll never forget, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's, I have a soft spot for Bob for that myself. So you were in two departments, pediatrics and epidemiology and biostat, and you know, today I think it's much easier to move between departments because we just bring the computer with you. But it was a serious commitment to stay in one or the other in those days, where your books were there,
yeah,
and
yeah.
your files and that sort
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
And you were most of the time at the children's hospital.
I was.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I remember you coming up to our department by bicycle and always with a helmet, right? Right from the beginning.
It's interesting that you say that.
I don't think
I could ever have bicycled up Peel Street.
You used to come to our department with a helmet somewhere. Yeah,
but
then I heard from somebody this week about some of the grief you gave to the motorists along the way.
Oh, indeed.
He said, Barry was not nice to motorists along the way when you were a cyclist. You still are.
Well, only when they're not nice to the bicyclists.
Exactly. What's the trouble in Montreal? I guess we'll come back to the whole thing in Montreal. But what is the issue here? Is it, are we exceptional, or this is a whole North American anti-bike culture, or what?
I think a bit of both.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. We'll get back to that in a while. Who did you work with in our department? I call it our department, epidemiology biostat. Any colleagues there? Well, you recruited Mike. You said you recruited Mike?
Yeah. Initially, I don't think I worked with anybody in particular at EPI, because EPI at the time was a, I think there were only four or five of us.
It was
and as you say, the core of the department was were the people in, interested in the asbestos issue.
That's
and so
right.
Forth.
Yeah.
And I was basically on my own until we began building the what became called the CDE Community Developmental and Epidemiologic Research, and that wasn't just a name of convenience to reflect the interests of the three amigos, if you like. I was the community part. Lauren Barr was the developmental person, and Mike Kramer was the epidemiologic person.
I see. I didn't see that.
Yeah, that was the connection, and that was why the name is. Rather than try to come up with a synthetic name, we just said, okay, well, we'll just
go. Those are the interests of the three of you.
And, and what we became, and built around that, because we added Charles Larson and Mike Moffat. We all had beards at the time, which was the important criterion for membership, was that we were, in effect, the first clinical EPI research group at McGill.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, and I've always looked to you guys as a model of, you know, how to do things.
Rightly so.
Yeah, exactly. So because you before you arrived there, was there anything like that at the Children's Hospital?
No. And it took a while for people at the Children's to acknowledge that the kind of research that we were doing was legitimate, scientific, was respectable, etc. I'm not
as opposed to the bench science.
There was no other model for the whole notion of clinical research was almost a different creature. One of the sort of ongoing themes of my academic career has been the tension between so-called hard and soft sciences. And when I received a research award from the Ambulatory Pediatric Association, my speech was about the fact that both were respectable scientific endeavors, that the distinction should not be exaggerated.
Did you have very much power when you were the director of clinical research at the Children's Research Institute? You were there for 12 years, or was that?
Yes, under the first scientific director, Rima Rosen. Well, actually, she was the second. The first was. Roy Grobel, who just didn't know what we were doing and let us alone. And then when I became director of clinical research, that was during Rima Rosen's time, and she was very supportive, and I think we made great strides in putting clinical research.
The funds for the Research Institute, would many of those funds have come from outside, from donors? And was that you were in the telethon?
The telethon was a huge source of funding. And we were increasingly successful at at national competitions and support from the FRSQ, and gradually more and more career awards, so people had more time for research. That was part of the reason for my ability to focus so much on research, was that I had a scientist award from NHRDP for a long, long period of time. The longest, I think.
And you didn't go after industry funding at all?
Not at all. Partly as a matter of principle, but also because the industry wouldn't have been interested in what we were doing anyway.
Right.
I don't think.
Yeah, but I mean, I think of industry as food and drugs, and there was feeding and that sort of thing, infant feeding. And
well,
are those companies interested in?
Yeah, probably.
If we had
chosen to do so.
You know. How did you must have met a lot of I call them regular community people on the boards of these various organizations for children, like in the telethon and those sort of things, you know, the volunteer organizations. Did you have much to do with them?
The year that I was scientific director of the Research Institute, the job really entailed doing precisely that, meeting with those people, going to endless dinners. And
that's right. But that children's research, research into children's health is probably an easy sell, but my impression of the public in general now is, are they as skeptical about some of us academics and feathering our own nests and, you know, not being grounded? Do you get the impression that the public is skeptical about research and there's so much of it every day that's saying what to do right and what to do wrong?
I think there's some big problems with epidemiologic research in particular because the messages that are emerging seem to contradict one another each week.
Yeah.
And
not so much in children's research.
Certainly the telethon always chose to focus on the visually dramatic aspects. And
I remember the leukemia.
Yeah, exactly, and the orthopedic miracles.
And myself, I've had a few sabbaticals where I've spent some of them in children's hospital, and it has been a very gratifying feeling. I have a sense walking into a children's hospital that whatever you do there in research is going to make a difference. Is that what you feel every day?
I think that the research does make a difference.
Yeah, but more so in children than anybody else. No?
Perhaps more so, but I'm not sure that I would include my own research in that assessment.
I mean, if I look now at the research interests you list in your CV, you have community pediatrics research, which is, you know, the tools, the designs, and the methods for doing the research, and then chronic disorders, injury prevention, and behavioral disorders. The design and methods, first, a little bit on that, and I think you have textbooks in that area. What are special challenges in involving children in community pediatric research? I don't mean clinical in the usual clinical bench stuff, but I mean in the community trials. What's especially challenging in studying children?
The fact that they're not all the same age.
I think anything
to do with children.
You mean instruments and so on?
Virtually all the measurement tools, whatever. This was one of the reasons why the Isle of Wight study was such a brilliant idea, was to say, let's take a narrow, you know, 3-year age period and focus on that.
I see.
Most of the kids are going to. But even that was.
A year is a lot in the child.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a general problem for doing pediatric research. My foci in each of those areas that you mentioned, in general, I'd like to think that I helped to convince people that clinical trials were possible in areas other than with respect to pharmaceuticals and that sort of thing. So for example, one of the things that had excited the people at McMaster was that we had done a study rather similar to what they had done on the Burlington
nurse
practitioner study.
But in children.
Involved with children with chronic illness and trying to be supportive and help prevent some of the secondary psychosocial sequelae.
By having nurses?
We looked at social workers, and we then looked at nurses, and we looked at laypersons.
Of the trials I know about in relation to you, I know one of them was a negative study, but in the nurses study, you were able to demonstrate benefits?
No, the social work study was a negative result. The nursing study, a bit of positive result. We massaged the data pretty hard. Interestingly, the family counselor, the lay counselors, which was a really terrific idea that came out of the blue, was the most successful, and of course none of those models were adopted. So one of the huge frustrations of doing research in general is the implementation issue,
and it's always when you have something to offer.
Have something you think you think you've got good evidence that it works, and yet it fails to be picked up.
I know I was going to mention that I think it's considered a negative study, the one with Martha Piper and you on the
well, it's negative yes, that was a study of children with Down syndrome, I think, primarily, and where the people who were involved with providing certain kinds of services were convinced that it was helping them with their development. And Martha's doctoral dissertation focused on an evaluation of that intervention and showed that it really made a difference.
What I remember hearing was that Martha was practically run out of town by the physiotherapist. Is that the story?
It was unpopular.
She was showing that something didn't work.
Exactly, which they had a huge investment.
Had there been more and more trials now in physiotherapy? Because I had a feeling, that if it worked, of course it works. Is that a fairly standard?
Well, it wasn't physiotherapy in the sense that you and I would think of it.
Oh, no.
So they were doing things, I don't remember exactly what they were doing, but
broader than
but when you stop and think about it, there was no good reason to think that it would. It's not like somebody with a fracture and you're trying to help to rehabilitate them.
I see. And then the whole shift from chronic disorders and that to injury. What? Because there is a fairly sudden shift in your career towards injury.
But just to put some closure to the chronic disease story, the main payoff, if you like, of what was probably half of my academic career was to, at least from a research point of view, establish that there was a solid basis for what we called the non-categorical approach to these children. That is, stop focusing on doing a disease-by-disease study. You know, we'll have to do it in diabetics, and then we're going to do it with cystics, and then we'll do it with children with asthma, and so forth.
So you wanted something more horizontal.
We wanted to be able to put groups together and study the phenomena of living with a chronic disorder.
I see.
And I think we succeeded in doing that for researchers. For clinicians, has by no means caught on. That was the notion of the Children's Rehab Services, was to say, these kids have a lot in common, and let's try and provide services for all of them that would be helpful. And that didn't succeed.
But should have, you think?
In terms of being adopted.
Yeah.
The switch to injury came in towards the end of the Rochester years. It was partially the result of bicycling to work and looking in people's cars as we pulled up together at stop streets and realizing that there were children in cars who were unrestrained. It had never been quantified before, the extent to which children were being transported without proper restraints, and this again was...
When did the whole idea come in?
Roughly, give or take, 1970. I think the first child seat law from Tennessee, Seymour Charles, no, not Seymour Charles, it was someone else, was about 1970.
And seatbelts themselves came in for adults?
Seatbelts were earlier, by about at least 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the child seat restraints came along, and then before the legislation appeared, and it was very, very late in Quebec, probably the last province in Canada to adopt any laws requiring the use of restraints. But but that's how the how I first became interested, and we were looking, we had a large grant, and we were looking for an intervention with a measurable outcome that was feasible, and a preventive intervention. And the seat restraint seemed to fill that bill very nicely. So we came at it in a sort of backward direction. And then as I began looking at the literature, I realized this is the major killer of children. This is a huge problem. And to the extent that it really is preventable, we're missing the boat. So I became a fervent evangelical convert, yeah. within the space of a year or so.
Did you do service yourself in the emergency rooms? I remember meeting you once in the children's hospital.
Yes, yes.
And so you would see the end result of these being wheeled in?
Sure. Although the children's at the time when I worked there, and I think still, the surgical cases were triaged.
Didn't see them.
And so we would see them in passing, and if there was some other reason for us to be involved.
A lot of the pressure I'm getting for myself for wearing a bicycle helmet is now from my own son, who was a surgeon and working in the emergency room and the trauma.
You have to be pressured. I'm distressed to hear that.
Well, Barry, we might as well get to that now instead of later. People tell me that in Holland, in the Netherlands, where they bicycle everywhere and can skate too, they don't have helmets and helmet laws. Is that true?
They do not have.
And how are they managing? Are they doing well? Or are they?
Well, first of all, a lot of people do wear helmets, but they certainly. One of the great stupid debates between the pro-helmet and anti-helmet legislation people is the notion put forward by the opposition, the anti-helmet law people, that if we require people to wear helmets, there'll be less pressure on to make the roads safer and create bike paths and so forth. And that's nonsense. I mean, we could and should have both. So it's a ridiculous argument. But in Holland, where there are huge numbers of cyclists, there are also huge numbers of bike paths. There's a whole culture which respects bicycling.
You see, when I say to my son, I said, I'm only going in this bike path in St. Lambert. I won't go on the street on a bicycle because I'm afraid of going under a car if something happens.
But there's a paradox there, though.
What's that?
Well, if you do go under a car, the helmet probably won't be of much help.
So
the helmet is not designed to protect you. It is, in fact, the little trip on the street where you hit a pothole or some jerk opens his car door and you get...
I see. What about on a bicycle path? The same...
Bicycle paths are not free... In Montreal, they're not free of potholes and other obstacles.
But if we had to look at the other end of where they're carried into the emergency room, and did what fraction of all the cases come from various... Which are the biggest kinds of accidents that cause the emergency room visits and so on?
Well, first of all, one of my great contributions is to try and remove the word accident from the entire...
I had meant to stay away from it, but I slipped back.
To the entire vocabulary.
Yes, the A word. I had a note here to avoid the A word.
Well, we actually at one point had persuaded the British Medical Journal that it and all of its 22 specialty journals would never use the A word. Didn't last, but and it created an unbelievable response of people who thought this was censorship.
I see.
But the reasoning behind that is that we argue that most injuries are not accidents; they're not acts of fate.
Acts of God, you mean?
Yeah. Well, God, fate, whatever. They're predictable. And therefore, they're preventable. If you say they're accidents, then in a sense, you're acknowledging that they're bad luck.
Yeah.
And nothing can be done to prevent them. So it was counterproductive.
I see. Now, just to, before going in detail into the injury area again, it looks like from, you've had about, I think, 30, if I count them up, 35 MSc and PhD students. Mm-hmm. And you've supervised in a very wide range of topics. So were you open to supervising anybody in any area of pediatrics? Or that's what it looks like.
Yes, and not just pediatrics. Yes. For several reasons. One is there wasn't anyone else in the department mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm. Follow your interests. You were willing to go with their interests.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And within limits, I don't know that there was anyone that I had ever. I mean, there were people who once Mike had come, mm-hmm. had Yves Bergevin, for example, and I mean.
Yeah,
having Martha Piper as my first doctoral student was
that didn't hurt.
It was downhill from that point on.
Yes. So, but now to get in, so you've mentioned how you got into the injury side yourself by watching and seeing what was happening and the laws coming in and the kids not being protected. Is that what
yes.
you're
yeah. Yes.
So is there much frustration there that things haven't gone as far as they should? You were complaining Quebec was one of the last to adopt. What is it that keeps these laws from being enacted? Can you tell? Is it lobbying from big from the car companies?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it's that at all. In fact, if anything, it's very more likely that they are potential allies for not necessarily altruistic reasons,
right.
I think, to avoid a lot of lawsuits and so
car.
On.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and there have been, certainly in the States, some very successful actions brought by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration against various manufacturers, starting back with... what's his name?
Nader?
There are two issues, I think. There's probably 10 issues, mm-hmm. but there are two factors that stand out. One is there is no pressure group, there's no lobbying effort from injury parents, for example.
I see.
Because
it's not like cancer or
exactly.
I see.
Exactly. And to the extent that those groups are able to lobby successfully, we can't. And I think it's because we failed to convince parents of children who have burns or those who have drowned or nearly drowned or those who fractured their skulls, that they have something in common. So this issue of numbers
and their isolation one from the other.
Yeah. Has begun to be over the years a lot an increase in focus from the head injury groups, but that's about it. So that's one on the push me side, and
yes.
on the pull me side, if you like, one of the things that I tried to do early on when I came to Canada was to persuade the federal government that it should have, I can't remember exactly what year it was that the Institute of Medicine had commissioned the other way around. The National Academy of Sciences in the States had commissioned the Institute of Medicine to look at the injury problem. And as a result of a report that they put together, the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control was created. And it, in turn, funded 10 or 12 university-based research and implementation groups, and they turned the picture around in the States, and there was leadership coming from the feds and
And there hasn't been that.
And we have never been able to accomplish that in Canada. And I can't tell you how many letters and how many ministers and deputy ministers that I've met with and how many promises we've had and so forth. So, and at one point, sorry.
No, I was going to say that, you know, that's a slightly different topic, but the closest organization I can think of that has gone anywhere with this is maybe the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. The whole business of drunk driving has changed over the last 30 or 40 years.
Absolutely.
And is there any analysis? What is it about that? Because that's sort of the same thing, preventable injuries.
Absolutely.
Are there any lessons there that we can use for the other injuries?
Yes, I think so. And I was on the national board of Mothers Against Drunk Driving for 2 terms. And I did so partly because someone in our department had lost a sister. And I felt I had to do something. We actually had a grand rounds where her husband, widow, participated.
Oh, yeah.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving changed the culture. I really think that's true, and both in the States and in Canada.
The tolerance for alcohol, I mean, the laws have tightened up, even the laws are tightening.
Absolutely, and even in the States, the move to from 0.08 to 0.05 is happening.
So you ever see the same thing with, is that because it's seen as something detrimental, that it's the person is doing something bad to begin with, and whereas the A word is what's causing us the trouble here, and the other one is just things are, you know.
No, so. I think it's because it's one thing. You can focus on it.
I see. It's clean example.
There is, there's always has been some form of legislation, so you could build on that. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has always had a lawyer as an ex officio member of its board. They've encouraged research, but there are a lot of people who've affected and who have climbed on board. Marjorie Le Breton, who was the head of the Senate, had a tragedy in her family, and she's been a member of the board for many years. Mm-hmm. And that kind of connection really helps, but it's so pervasive, unfortunately.
You had a lot to do with the Canadian Injury Reporting and Prevention Program called CHIRP, right?
Yeah.
That
was my baby, and the reason that came into being was that I had been a visiting professor in Melbourne, and I saw the surveillance system that was in operation in the state of Victoria, and it occurred to me that one of the reasons we were making little progress in Canada was that the only statistics that we had to go by at the time were the mortality figures, which always, I was naive. I sort of thought that politicians would be impressed by numbers, and if we could persuade them that there were more children who were being injured than those who had simply died or being hospitalized. Mm-hmm. So what was missing was the ER component.
I see. And which is what, 10 or 50 times the mortality?
It's 40 to 50 times, exactly. And that's what the state of Victoria system was, VIS it was called.
Yeah.
And so I came and met with the deputy minister and persuaded her that we should have such a system here.
That's ongoing now.
It's into something like 20 million cases in the database. But it's not a good sample. It doesn't have a denominator. It's better than nothing.
I see. You mean it's in selected cities only?
It's in
it's
all the children's hospitals.
Okay.
But that still doesn't make a population-based...
I see. If you go to the local.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see.
So, but there have been a lot of important publications that have come from it, but it has not. I mean, in a sense, one could almost argue that it's backfired because it gives the feds a way of saying we're sincerely concerned about this problem. We have CHIRP, and therefore we don't have to do anything else.
Now, one other, it's a side example, but of a change that's happened, a big change in the way children are brought up or the way children are put down to sleep, is this back-to-sleep business. That's a lot of people saw SIDS as an accident, you know, one of these unpredictable things. That's the way I grew up, it's one of those bad luck things that happens to you. What's your analysis of the what's happened there? There's been a major change in policy, and parents have switched over, some of them a little grudgingly, but...
No, that's a huge, marvelous success story. I mean, it's a small piece of research, and an easy intervention, and a message that was easily delivered.
So compared to buckling up a child, what's different?
Far easier, far cheaper to turn your child over than it is to buy a car seat.
But it's a routine kind of. It's a routine thing. I mean, that's what I like about these. It's a routine you can get used to.
Right.
Just like putting your seatbelt on.
Yes. Yes.
And yet it succeeds, and the buckling up and the other things are not. And the getting on the cell phone is another worse thing. Maybe you don't want to go there.
Well, just the one small aside. We haven't talked about this, but I don't consider CHIRP to be a huge contribution to the field. What I do consider to have been an important contribution is that in 1995, I became the founding editor of a BMJ specialty journal called Injury Prevention.
Oh, yes, now I've come to that.
And I mention that in the context of this part of the discussion because we never considered SIDS as an injury. In the same way as I resisted for a long time as editor, including child abuse, for a number of reasons. One was that there was a journal that devoted itself to child abuse, and Dick Krugman and I respected one another, so we agreed not to invade each other's turf.
Yeah.
But also, I have never felt that it was a field in which good research could be done.
I see.
I still feel that way.
Yeah. Before going on to that, one more thing on Quebec. I mean, here lots of people tell me that you had a lot to do with the legislation and so on in Quebec. So you yourself say you didn't have that much to do with it, but I think you did. But is it that there are so few people willing to stick their neck out and that you were more prominent, or how did that? Why is that perception grown that you had so much to do with?
Well,
the introductions of the laws here. I remember you writing to the newspapers and this, that, and the other thing.
Well, we had a spring ritual at the children's, spring coming in various times a year, that the minute the snow got off the ground, we would find some funds to have somebody stationed in front of the hospital and observe and record the number of children who were arriving who were unrestrained. And we wrote paper after paper each year reminding the Quebec government that without legislation, the majority of children would be unrestrained. And finally, it happened. I don't see a cause and effect relationship. I think there were many things going on. It may have helped a bit, but we certainly were very interested in child seat restraint use. One of the better master's theses that I supervised was René Vero. Remember, and that was his the topic. And we were comparing seat restraint use in Calgary. I can't I guess it was Vancouver and Montreal, and we had...
I remember one where you had people at four shopping centers in Montreal, and there was something to do with it. Was that a TV message that time? You got something where it was a French English, you were very clever about the use of the advertising messages in French and English television.
Yeah, I don't remember what the intervention was, but you're right, we did.
It was a coverage issue between the French and English. And you had certain shopping centers that had more English clientele and others that were...
I don't think that was the design, but you're right.
And you having people stationed outside watching whether your child...
I mean, I think that the important point to be made is that this was a topic that concerned us because we knew it was an effective intervention. And again, it was a question of how to get it to the next stage of implementation. And as with many things in the injury field, having legislation and having that legislation enforced and having people convinced that their chances of being arrested,
caught
was high, with a significant penalty, was an important adjunct.
So you're a strong believer then in the legislation side.
Absolutely, still am, and that's where the cell phone stuff comes in.
I see. Yeah, but do you think we have any? We're going to have any luck with the cell phone behaviors? It's more complicated because surveillance is harder, isn't it?
It's much harder. It's hard for the police.
Yeah.
The penalties aren't very great, and between those two variables that I mentioned as being important, neither of them are there. So in an editorial that we recently wrote in the BMJ, we said we believe the solution is going to come from technology, that there'll be more and more cell phones that are built in such a way that they
sense where they are, and
where they won't work with when the
moving cars.
Key.
And so on.
Exactly.
I see. Now, you've mentioned there already the journal Injury Prevention. How did that come about, that journal, the setting up of that journal? Did they come to you? Did you go to them?
It was while I was on a sabbatical in London at the Child Accident Prevention Trust. Mike Hayes, who was their research officer, and myself became good friends, and we both came to the conclusion, I think it was really Mike's lead, that something was needed that would disseminate both research and what programs were being conducted and whatnot. We approached the BMJ. The person responsible for the specialty journals, Alex Williamson, was excited, thought it was a good idea, took it to the board, sold it. Richard Smith was the editor at the time.
Oh.
He had the majors of the BMJ, that makes him ex officio the editor of all the specialty journals as well. And he bought into it as well, and so the journal came into being.
Yeah, I remember you consulted me on a colleague on one of the first studies.
That's right.
With a very interesting trial that was going on in
Sweden.
Linköping or something.
Linköping and Falköping.
That's right. And I was impressed at how carefully they could do their... First of all, that they could implement this. It was some sort of a thing about children on the roads and buses, I think.
I don't remember all the components, and that was part of the problem, was that the actual components of what was in the black box were never as clear as they should have been.
But it's clear that the places in Scandinavia, like Sweden and so on, are they ahead of us, way ahead of us?
Unbelievably huge difference in the statistics that and have been probably for 30 to 40 years.
Are the Scandinavians unique, or are Europe in general is ahead of us?
No, Sweden has always been ahead of the Scandinavian countries by and large are ahead of the rest of Europe.
They're ahead of us in child, what do you call them, too, infant mortality rates as well, aren't they?
That I don't know.
I think they are.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
No.
But what is it? Have you any sense of what it is about their psyche or about their value of life, or what is it that?
Well, Sweden did what I wanted Canada to do, which was to have a central focus, and the focus was under the leadership of a pediatrician, Ragnar Bjerfenstrom, who was an honorary editor of the journal from day one, who persuaded the various interest groups and the central government to climb on board and focus on the injury problem. And within years, the figure, the statistics began to reflect their success.
I see. Now, a little bit on the publishing side itself. As an editor, it must be interesting seeing people from the other side. You know, normally we only see the editors as contributors ourselves and getting answers back from editors. What was it like being an editor? Did you get to see a different side of people, of academics, when their papers aren't accepted and this, that, and the other thing? Did you?
It's a pretty all-consuming job, it's time-consuming. I was a more of a hands-on editor than I probably should have been, so I did a lot of actual editing to try.
And when they saw you later, did they give you grief?
No, not at all. I think people were always. I don't think they were necessarily enamored when I would change witches to theys and things like that.
Yeah. Did you have a high acceptance rate in the period?
Not initially.
No.
And that was part of the original struggle, was to get papers, enough papers that we could reject a respectable proportion.
Yeah.
No longer the issue. I mean, it's, journal's now 20 years old and...
mature. Is publishing changing fast? Is that your impression?
And absolutely.
Yeah. And is it going to stay even, or will we have something completely different?
I think print journals are going to be hugely in jeopardy.
Yeah.
The open access area we thought was going to be the panacea and has turned out to be trying to find a polite word where I won't get sued, but it's turned out to be a trap in the hands of unscrupulous publishers who invite people to submit papers and then they later discover that
they want to live off of them,
be $2,000 or $5,000 to be published. But undoubtedly, electronic publishing will be the way things are going to go in the future.
Now, you wrote a lot of editorials in your time. I almost lost count trying to.
Yeah, I meant.
But did you invite lots of editorials when you were?
Yes.
Do you consider them fairly influential?
Yes. It's a very good question, Jim.
The reason I'm asking is the older I get and the lazier I get, I'll read the conclusions, but I'll go to the editorial to see what's really going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think editorials are very important, but one of the problems about life in general, and publishing in particular, and editorials in more particularly, is that there's not a lot of feedback that. You assume that lots of people have read your editorial. You assume that most people agree or disagree, but you rarely get an email or a note saying, I loved your editorial, I agree with you completely. Editorials are cited quite often.
Yes, I use them to tell students to go and read about the state of the affairs in a particular area.
Sure.
You know, that those people are the wise people.
Yeah.
And did you have an easy time finding people who would be that, or who could do the job of writing editorials?
Sure. I try to write an editorial for each issue.
Oh, yourself?
Yeah. but I also tried to get a member of the editorial board or somebody else to write either an editorial or a commentary.
Yeah.
And for a while we tried to have encourage an opinion and dissent column, which many journals have.
Yeah.
Those are tricky.
You've met a lot of journal editors, I imagine, in your job
as
well. Yes. What were they like as a community?
Well, I have huge respect for good journal editors, many of them have a very tough job because they're not always as independent as they should be.
Yeah.
And depending on who owns the journal, they may have to do battle not only with authors and reviewers, but also with their owners.
Yeah.
And as we know, even with the Canadian Medical Association Journal, we had
quite a spat.
Big unfortunate development.
Would you change any advice for authors now, or young people in general writing articles? Do you have any advice for them about what they should be doing and paying attention to in their article?
Absolutely.
What recurring themes were there in your advice to authors?
Well, probably I could boil things down to two or three main bits of advice, but just to say that I have a passion for writing, and I have a passion for other people writing well, and so I'm still very much a crusader for avoiding cliches and whatnot. As you know, Abby and I originally, and then Abby and I have taught a course in the department.
On writing.
More broadly on scientific presentations, so it was preparing stuff for PowerPoints and things like that as well.
Yeah.
The cardinal rule for writing is simplicity, clarity. I mean, if people don't understand what you've written, then you've lost the battle. And that means at one point you were going to ask me who my favorite writers were, and I was going to tell you that Strunk and White, of course, wrote the Bible, but interestingly, E.B. White was also one of the favorite writers of the children's books.
That's right.
And that's not a coincidence. I mean, the fact is that you're writing a children's book, you have to write clearly, and it has to be understood.
I would put it.
And it carried over into the writing of the Elements of Style, which is every writer's Bible. I think the other thing that authors often overlook, and apart from writing clearly, and I should add that good punctuation is one way, a hugely potent tool for helping you to write clearly, and bad punctuation can really make it far more difficult
for
people
to understand. That book by the English lady on the panda is a great example.
Yes.
Abby and I have been trying to get something published where somebody else in our department was going over a dossier for promotion. I think this is okay to say. And there was something on a table, the heading of the table, so I'm talking about death by logistic regression.
Yes, I've heard that story.
You might even have been there for it. But yes, that goes on quite a bit. So now a little bit more on advocacy. We've spoken a lot about your intervening and setting the research agenda and also setting the policy agenda. First, is it okay for researchers to have two hats, one as a researcher and one to be advocating for policy changes? Do you see any problem there, or do you see...
I understand.
Get over...
I understand the arguments that come from respected epidemiologists who say it's inappropriate.
Yeah.
I don't agree. Mm. In fact, I take the exact opposite position. I think that if you're going to do research in a field where, which is not a basic science, I mean, if you're doing basic science, you just put the stuff out
there.
That's
right, that's right. Nobody cares most of the time.
And there's a basic science element of epidemiology biostatistics, which would fall into that category. But if you're doing research around population health problems or clinical research, and you have no interest or desire or sense of obligation that the findings, your findings, if they're, if there is a message from them, gets heard and acted upon, then I think you're being irresponsible.
I see. Yeah.
And I think you have an obligation to try and make the transition from the printed page to some kind of action if the data warrant it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so do you think maybe at this point when a journal or when you publish your article that you should make some kind of a presse of it and make a little release to give to the politicians or give to the people who should be just proactively rather than...
Well, if I thought politicians...
Are they the ones?
No,
or legislators?
No, joking aside, if I thought they would read it and act upon it, it would be worth doing. When I was editor, I always asked authors to conclude with a brief statement about the implications of this particular research for injury prevention. And it was often difficult for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good test, almost a litmus test of whether the paper belonged in our journal,
whether
it was a good fit. Yeah. Because if there wasn't a prevention message in the paper, then... But if there was, then you'd expect the author to do something to disseminate it further and to encourage people to act upon it.
Yeah. And it brings up the issue of, you know, your other uses of other avenues or other outlets you had. Like, you wrote a lot to the newspapers and you lobbied and whatever you made yourself live. Did it get anywhere? Or, were you trying to? No?
I don't know.
You're still frustrated?
I doubt it.
Hmm?
I very much doubt it.
I see.
What it accomplishes is it gives you a better night's sleep.
I see. You feel you've tried. Yeah, okay. Now, a little bit more on your own...
Just to give you a recent example for Montreal audience.
Yeah.
I wrote what I thought was a thoughtful and persuasive op-ed about the sprinklers versus smoke alarms when following the tragic circumstances in the old folks.
The committee op-ed that those are commissioned, or you initiated it?
No, I wrote, it was never published.
I see.
But I felt there was a lot of discussion that was being dismissed by government people about the importance of installing sprinklers.
Yes.
The argument being that smoke detectors were
good
cheaper
enough
and more effective. And my argument was we need both.
The statistic convinced me is that there's never been apparently in any place with sprinklers that work fatalities of any kind.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, they cost a lot to put in at the beginning, but yeah. Yeah. So, but it never, nobody took it?
No, it was sent to the Gazette and they didn't have the courtesy to say we're not interested.
Now, going on a little more now, personal, and you know, the awards that you're kind of most proud of. I know you're not a big person on that sort of thing, but still, there must be one or two you say, you're a little extra proud of that you're willing to say. No?
Well,
the Order of Canada, for one, no?
Well, the Order of Canada was interesting because I think it was wonderful to receive, and it was a great dinner. I received it for the wrong reason. I think if it was deserved at all, it was deserved for putting injury prevention
yeah.
on the map in Canada.
Yeah, but it wasn't for that?
But it was, the citation made reference to the clinical activities.
Oh, I see.
Which probably has to do with who the nominees
yes.
were.
Nominators, yeah.
But I guess perhaps a more important recognition was I was the first and actually only president of the Ambulatory Pediatric Association, now called the Academic Pediatric Association. There are three scholarly North American Pediatric Society for Pediatric Research, and the American Pediatric Society, and the Ambulatory Pediatric Association. And I was elected president of that, and as I say, I was the only
Canadian
to ever have served in that
yeah.
capacity. But there was a trifecta that came with it, that followed, and that I was a recipient of that organization's Armstrong Award and Research Award.
And were those for the right citation, for the right reason, for the injury prevention side of it?
No, they were for
chronic diseases. Pediatric research
leadership in the field and
Now we mentioned some of the trials already, I guess, did we?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so I won't go over that. Is there anything more you want to add on those, or?
No, I think as we move to talking about the future, I suppose
But I think let me go on then. A few of the I looked to the publications and all the citations and so on. I picked out one or two, may not be the most cited ones. One of them, your very first paper, a rapid screening test for intelligence in children. I mean, I was curious how that arose and what's it for. Is it still used, or is it a research tool? Or?
Well, yeah, it was called a quick test, and it was, and it's a part of a sort of a the team that I was with at the Mass General consisted of a psychologist and a pediatrician who had come from practice to do research at the Mass General. And we were studying children with chronic illnesses, and I thought it was important to, because many of those children were retarded as part of their syndromes, as children with cerebral palsy and so forth, that we needed to have a variable included in the in whatever it was we were...
Along with many other things.
Yeah.
I see.
So
we
came across the quick test, and we ended up... doing a study comparing it against the WISC, the standard
full version,
and showed a high correlation. It was an interesting. It was a picture vocabulary test, and there's always been a stream in child psychology where people were convinced, and I think they were correct, that vocabulary is highly correlated with intelligence.
Interesting. We mentioned the one with Martha Piper on the Down syndrome, but there's one other, and I have to mention this because when I was asking a couple of days ago people about you and some of their memories, they mentioned that one pediatrician is telling me that your American colleagues, pediatric colleagues, some of them regard you almost as a communist, and that you've been calling for universal health care in the United States. And it ties in with a paper that you and Jack Simicki and Leslie Richardson published in the New England Journal after Medicare had been here in 1980. Is that the reason, I wonder, that had you a lot to do with that paper?
Yes.
And that was just after Medicare had come in here, right? It was the access to the, you know, what had changed in private and in doctor's visits and in...
Yes.
What did that show? That leveled the field very quickly here, did it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The
Wasn't the worry that all that's going to happen with Medicare is the rich are going to go to the doctors more and more, and the poor still won't.
That was a worry which was unfounded.
Yeah.
One thing that hadn't been anticipated is that doctors would actually end up working less than they did before, because they were being paid.
I see.
They didn't have to worry about
it. And there were no uncollected
bills.
I see.
But my reputation as a communist or socialist is well deserved. My presidential speech to the APA was focused very much on differences between what was going on in the States and what was going on in Canada. I continue to make that point around the firearms issue. It's something that I do the blog for the journal, and that I'm constantly harping away at. I don't know if you know that some American was stopped at the border because he had a handgun in his glove compartment.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just 2 days ago.
I've been watching Piers Morgan on the Americans on the school shootings.
Have you
taken any position on that yourself?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
What would your advice to them be? In the short term, though. Surely you're not thinking of putting armed guards in schools, are you?
No, of course not. I'm thinking of having
tougher
handgun and AK-47 removed from the.
I think the
position of the NRA is just evil force.
But I think Morgan won't care. Any of them won't get any. My impression is that the forces are very, very strong there.
Yeah, but what will have to happen is going back to Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I think that groundswell of public opinion is
with each new episode, maybe yesterday.
It's terrifying.
Now, so we've covered a lot of the research. Just quickly, we talked a little bit about the teaching with Abby on the writing course. You also taught for many years the research design course, mm-hmm. and I'm very curious whether you think that's a skill that can be taught, or whether that's innate in researchers, that some of them have it and some haven't. Or did you feel like you could get places with students on that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. I haven't. I should go back, and if I had more time.
Mm-hmm.
It's surprising in retirement how little time you have, but I'm not sure.
Yes.
Well, that's a paradox, I know.
Yeah.
But it would be, I have the distinct impression that people who took that course, by and large, have continued to do research, either at the margins or mm-hmm. very seriously. Many have become very successful researchers. But what's interesting, Jim, is that when I was director of clinical research at the Children's, how little knowledge of research design clinical researchers have. So
the bench people.
No, the clinical researchers. Clinical researchers.
Clinical.
So you have a rheumatologist or a nephrologist would come to you and say, I want to do such and such a study.
I see.
And you'd say, use terms like case control, and they look at you and say, well, you know, what sort of design are you? So what would happen is that they would assume, and this always troubled me, that if they added a statistician to their team or an epidemiologist, but there weren't, those issues would be taken care of. It's inconceivable, but it obviously happens, that you can do clinical research without having any knowledge of research design or data analysis or what have you.
Interesting. And your broad approach to teaching is what? Is it traditional or is it unusual? I remember your students having to do hands-on stuff in some of those research courses.
In the research design course, we always did, and I think it was often two or three let's say there were 20 students in the class, we'd divide up into groups of three or four, mm-hmm. and each group would do a project, and very often the projects came to completion and were written up by one or two of the students.
You had observation studies when they were out in street corners, did you?
Yeah, that sort of thing? Yeah. All kinds of stuff.
Now, a little bit on your spare time. You mentioned retirement and so on, having that much spare time, but have you got, I know you have music as a hobby. What others do you have? Is that enough?
That's enough. I mentioned I'm trying to write a children's book.
Uh-huh.
That's been a struggle. My grandchildren keep telling me that
you're testing it on them. Or?
Oh yes,
I see.
They're helping me. the music is has come and gone, but
I remember you came back from sabbatical from London, and I missed the seminar, but I heard I missed a great little piece on the clarinet at the end, which you had just taken up, right?
Yeah.
During sabbatical.
Yeah. Well, it's I had actually when I gave my research award presentation.
Uh-huh.
I played Amazing Grace at the end of the presentation because I was trying to make a point about hard and soft sciences. So I played Amazing Grace in two different keys, and I said, look, the tune's the same. It's just the keys that are different. And so there's a metaphor.
Did I hear you talking about switching over to the piano?
Well, yeah, the clarinet was a 50th birthday gift, and an 80th birthday gift from my son was some piano lessons. And I actually took lessons from his excellent teacher for about a year. And then I got too busy with other things. But I've recently gone back, and I nearly got Bach's Prelude in C minor mastered.
Nailed.
Yeah.
All right. I want to go back now a little bit to the way back in the past, then, I call it then and now, and a little bit on the future. I'm very interested in your view of the contribution of epidemiology in general to mankind. Some people in the journal for American Journal of Epi interviews, they ask people who are the most important epidemiologists. I don't want to ask that. I'd rather ask you, what do you think epidemiology and public health's greatest contribution to mankind has been over the century? If you have to go back looking at it from the pediatric point of view, what is it that we can say that either medicine, public health, epidemiology, call it what you want, has given to the world? Or should the geographers be saying, we give you America, or we found this, or we went to the moon, or whatever? What is it about health that you would say is the biggest achievement in the last...
Well, there's two different ways of answering that question, I suppose. I mean, if you want to talk about epidemiology...
I mean it in the broadest sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, the smoking and...
In this
story,
in the last century.
Yeah, will be, the last century's equivalent of the Broad Street pump.
Yeah.
But, maybe the seatbelt will be the more recent example of a huge triumph. The reason I attribute those to epidemiology is because to me epidemiology doesn't stand out there. It is the intrinsic essence of scientific research, broadly speaking.
For population?
No.
In general?
In general. I mean, certainly when we do clinical research, the tool is epidemiology.
I see.
The designs are epidemiologic.
I see.
The data analysis are...
But that's why I ask people, what if you were in a sociology department or a geography department? Would they be making the same claims that it's their research methods are what's led us to knowledge?
They might, but they would. I think they'd be wrong. I mean, it's a bit presumptuous, but I think the essence of science it's hard to separate the essence of scientific inquiry from epidemiology. I mean, I think the tools of scientific reasoning have been adopted. I don't know which way around it goes, but I think they're one and the same. And I have a rather hugely broad sense of that epidemiology is the essence of scientific inquiry, because the fundamental notions about causality are buried in the tools that we use.
Okay, so it's very much the way you're talking is you're talking very much about the research and the research tools and the research thinking. But if we had to think of the fruits of epidemiology, not the the end product of what it's brought us, do you consider vaccination over the last several hundred years as a triumph for? Is that for medicine or is it public health? It's got to be a triumph for somebody.
Sure, it's a good question, Jim, but a strange one because you're slipping from epi to public health.
Yeah,
and of course. Just the same way as you jumped in and said, yeah, but that's, with respect to population inquiries. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, it's also clinical. The public health discoveries of the last are very important. How much did epidemiology have to do with them? To use vaccination as an example? Mm-hmm. In some cases, a lot, and in other cases, very, very little. Okay?
Because. Example, you mean?
Well, smallpox, for example.
Okay.
That was not, correct me if I'm wrong, that was not an epidemiologic kind of inquiry.
I see.
That led to our belief that this was going to be an effective way of controlling that disease.
Right.
And subsequently, as vaccination spread, you could say that there was epidemiology played a role. But even then, I'm a little uncertain about.
I see. Yeah.
So I don't necessarily. See the connection. I mean, certainly.
Okay. This was somebody else's way of looking. Yeah, I was just curious what you thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so you have obviously accepted. Did you feel as a pediatrician that you ever had to promote vaccinations? Or that's another area where I think things have been slippery. No.
I mean. It never occurred to me that people would ever be foolish enough to argue that vaccination was not a good idea. And then, of course, it happened.
Yes. And I think when we got frauds like Wakefield and so on, people were very happy to say, oh, well, maybe there are dangers.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, there are countries where the uptake
religious
is,
reasons and so on. Yeah.
And just to bring it very close to home, to realize that among health professionals in Montreal or in Quebec, with respect to flu immunization, vaccination, the uptake is low.
I see.
Ridiculously low.
It's interesting because I asked Corp MacDonald, head of our department at one point, Corbett, do you get the flu shot every winter? He said, waste of time, waste of time. He says, it's never been proven that they're worth anything.
He may be right. But I used to.
You take
like Corbett, I certainly, yes.
Yeah, you take some of yourself. Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so let's close up then by looking a little for the next generation. What advice you'll be giving them? Is it still an area you think people should go into, the same area you've gone into? Would you tell them to go into genomics or go into something else sexy?
No, because I really meant what I said, and I am convinced that epidemiology is the central pathway to scientific inquiry, that even if they were going to do genomics or whatever,
these are tools
fundamental tools and the kind of reasoning that epidemiologists and biostatisticians are required to pursue.
Right.
And the appreciation of how those tools relate to our ability to infer causal relationships is so central that I would almost be prepared to say something outrageous like, everybody should do it, no matter what else they do subsequently.
It
becomes the infrastructure
no prescription or no advice as to what particular substantive areas they would should be focusing on. Do you think some are overrated now and not going to get us very far?
I think
the genomics thing, should people be really putting their money there, and should the taxpayer be putting its money there?
I don't know enough about it to comment really intelligently. My instincts tell me that it's being oversold.
Right.
I don't know.
And for the MSc and PhD students who do 2 years at McGill or 4 years at McGill, what would you tell them to spend their time doing?
I would
besides having a good time or whatever, but
I would encourage them to do. You mean in terms of substantive topics?
Well, what skills should they be picking up for their next 35 years of their career? I guess
what our department offers. I think I think that by and large, I think there are some deficiencies. I think, for example, the fact that. You know, one of the final pathways for anybody who's a scholar in any field is publication. And if you can't write, your research is only going to be able to go so far. So I'm disappointed that the department no longer offers course such as the one that we did. Maybe what we provided was not that successful. It's hard to judge.
I've directed students recently to online versions of it, but I have a feeling that it's much harder to do when you don't have somebody there.
Yeah, I think the feedback is every assignment that we gave was given back and with very careful comments and with the message, you know, understand why we think that word, that choice of word, that punctuation mark, that structure of the sentence, that organization of the paragraph was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, why it could be improved, mm-hmm. Why it could be more.
Have I missed any area that you wanted to make a special message or give a special message to? or have we covered most of the areas?
I think the only thing we haven't talked much about, but we could talk for ages and probably not make much progress, is about the relationship between research, science, and policy.
Uh-huh.
Which I think is very important, but I have some very pessimistic views about that, having spent so much of my academic career naively thinking that there was a relationship.
I see.
Discovering, to my great disappointment, that there probably
But you're still a cheerful person, Barry, and still getting lots of fun out of life. Right?
Yeah, but I hope so, but I'm cynical.
Well, maybe we'd have to start back with those children's books, and I want to see them when they're done. Barry, on behalf of the department, many, many thanks, and many, many more years of good health.
Thank you very much. Thank you.